KYW News Radio Original Podcasts.
It's just a good conversation with someone you didn't know you were interested in. I'm Matt Leon, and this is One-on-One, sponsored by your Delaware Valley Honda dealers. Get a deal you'll like on a Honda you'll love.
The style in which we're going to play, you know, it's going to be fast, physical, and relentless, and they're going to do all those things, and that starts with you being connected. You wanted to play as hard as humanly possible for the person next to you, and I think if we can continue to harp on that, and it's all about the relationships and caring for our teammates, and I think the scoreboard's going to take care of itself.
And our guest this week is Rick Santos. He is the new head football coach at the University of Pennsylvania. Comes to the Quakers via New Hampshire, where he had a great run as head coach. He was also one of the best quarterbacks you've ever seen during his playing days at New Hampshire. And Rick, thanks so much for coming in.
Appreciate you having me. Thank you.
So you had a lot of success in your tenure at New Hampshire. Why was Penn the right job at the right time for you?
Yeah, you know what? That was one of the hardest decisions I've ever had to make from in a professional setting. And I love my guys back home. They meant a lot to me. You know, I'm in this profession for the relationships and developing those guys and really just trying to be a servant leader and doing everything I can to for those guys to kind of live out their dreams. So to leave home was hard. Some things that we felt like we couldn't control there, you know, i.e. budget constraints, you know, we were getting slashed. From the state, some other things that kind of had some confines that we really felt like it was going to hamper us. And we felt like we almost kind of hit a plateau, and that might have been first round of the playoffs. Didn't know if we were going to be able to kind of get further from there. And from a competitive standpoint, you know, I'm someone that always wants to strive to be the best and challenge myself. So there were some things that happened behind the scenes there that felt like were going to hurt us. But I think most importantly, it was because of what this conference offers. I think the Ivy League is the last conference in all of Division I truly with the academic model being at the center. Truly believe in developing the student, you know, first and the student athlete. And that's gone by the wayside with the transfer portal and everything else. It's got a lot more convoluted. So people are going to choose UPenn and these Ivy League schools because of the degree. We're not completely insulated from the transfer portal, but for the most part, we feel like 90-95% of our guys are going to be here for 4 years. They're choosing it because of the network, the degree, what it's going to do for their professional career. So we felt like we can have the guys for 4 years. We can instill our culture. We can instill our way of life. And by the time you're a junior and senior now, you're the one that is emulating those programmatic standards. You can show the young guys how you operate, and then all of a sudden you have success and you have that buy-in that starts to happen when you recruit the right guys and we coach the right way. Then you can sustain, you know, excellence for a long period of time. And we felt like this conference allowed us to do that and can do it at a high level.
How big is the Ivies now taking part in the FCS playoffs in making this, not this job, but this league even more attractive?
Yeah, I don't think I would have probably taken the job if that wasn't the case. It was a way of life up there, and I think 17 out of 21 years we made the playoffs, and every year as a student athlete that I was playing and contributing, and every year I think but one as an assistant coach and three out of the last four as a head coach. So those are some of the things that we always strive for every single year. We wanted to be a top 24 team and compete to hopefully win a national championship one day, and we had a lot of teams that were really close in capturing that. And so now the fact that the Ivy League has the ability to play late in the postseason, I think because of that you're going to see in the next 3 to 5 years that the Ivy League is going to be one of the top FCS conferences. I don't think that the national beat writers, the national pollsters, people that were making decisions in the top 25 voting over the last decade or so has given this conference enough credit. And playing Dartmouth every single year and being an interstate rival at New Hampshire, like, we know how good they are. And, you know, we've played out of conference games against Harvard, and we've had a lot of crossover with some teams in the conference when you're doing some scouting on your opponents. And I mean, this is a phenomenal conference top to bottom. There's so much balance, and I'm excited to kind of see what we do on a national stage.
I mean, I honestly think, maybe with the exception of Cornell, I think every other school in the time that I've been broadcasting covering Penn football has had at least one team that you're like, oh, if they could have gone to the playoffs, they would have won at least one game.
I mean, the 2017 year when we were at Columbia working under Coach Bagnoli, that team was as good as any team that I've coached or played on, and we were 8-2 and lost a couple heartbreakers to Harvard and Yale, and that was a top 25 team. And Harvard and Yale every single year, I think the going on probably the last decade, has a shot to be a top 25 team. You know, the Princeton teams in the mid 2000s, 2015, those teams were epic, and Dartmouth and what they've done the last 8 to 10 years, winning multiple championships, and I think those teams are as strong as anybody as well. So yeah, I really think the top teams that finish top four in this conference every single year can compete.
What specific challenges, and you have Ivy League experience, as you mentioned, being an assistant at Columbia, so some of the uniqueness that you have to deal with as an Ivy head coach is not new to you, but what challenges does the Ivy League present from a head football coaching standpoint that you might not have to deal with at other places?
Yeah, I think in the recruitment process, I think it's vastly different in terms of being need-based financial aid versus having a scholarship in your back pocket to hand out. Obviously, recruiting high academic young men and the academic index and how you calculate and some of the Ivy League banding is a little more convoluted than it used to be. And those 3 years that I was at Columbia, it was basically, you know, not to nerd out on it, but it was 2/3 standardized tests, 1/3 unweighted GPA, and that would give you a number. And you had to fit somewhere in, you know, 183 was the floor and 220 was the highest, and you had to fit somewhere in those academic bandings. Now it's a lot of it is based on the rigor that you take, how many APs versus how many honors classes, what is the school profile. And some schools went test optional post-COVID, and now some of the schools in the conference still have stayed that. We have not. We require a test score. So now you're battling against – you're winning a recruiting battle in terms of, hey, we love your culture. We love the vision of that you're setting forth for the program. Really like the relationships that you built with us in the process. We love your coaching staff. But my test score is here. You're saying I got to get 100 points more and Columbia can get me in on this merit. And you might lose a recruiting battle that way. So there's a lot more that goes into it than just – being a really good recruiter. And those are some of the things that you need to know, the nuances of it. You need to know which guys we need to really go after that are gonna fit in those proper metrics, which guys we're spinning our tires and wasting time on. And obviously with Wharton and being one of the best business opportunities you're going to find really in the whole world, it's like, okay, hey, we have someone who's good enough to get into Wharton. Like, that guy needs to be now on the top of our priority list, right? So, like, there's a lot more nuance and a lot more strategy, I think, in recruiting. Those are probably some of the challenges.
From a recruiting standpoint, as a head coach, how do you approach it? Are you one of many on your staff and you all kind of do the same thing and then meet it as a group? Are you more the closer? Like, everybody kind of brings to you, hey, I like X, Y, and Z. What do you think? Let's watch film. Like, how are you in the process?
Yeah, I think everyone's process is a little bit different. Some schools and programs, they facilitate and start everything area-based. So every coach has an area, and that's not new to any program. That's going to be a kind of status quo everywhere. But a lot of places, your first 6 months of recruiting, it's all based on area. We start positionally. So everyone has an area that they'll eventually get to in the spring when we hit the spring recruiting trail. But we start everything positionally. So the position coach will rank it. If he deems someone good enough to, from an athletic standpoint, that he can be an offer, he will then pass it along the chain of command to the coordinators. They rank their top guys, and the guys that the coordinators feel like are good enough for me to see, then they will pass it up, and then ultimately I'll have the final say on it. But it's very much collaborative. We have multiple meetings per week to kind of go over the boards. You'd see where they're at. So it really starts – the first eval is going to be strictly – from a football standpoint, are they good enough, right? And once we deem them, hey, yes, we think he's an offer, before we extend that offer, let's make sure the academics check out. And then most importantly, let's make sure the character checks out. Is he a leader? Does he love football? Is he a winner? Is he hopefully competing for state championships? Does the coach, you know, we have 20 or so questions that are checklists that we have for the head coaches and position coaches, and make sure that he's going to fit our type of guy. We get to that point, he checks all of it, then we'll extend the offer. And once we've done all of that, we've done all the background work on this guy, and I know he's an offer and he checks all the boxes, that's when I put him on my list of like weekly calls, Zooms, reaching out to the parents, making sure that I can be the one, like as you mentioned, to be the closer. So our staff does a phenomenal job in the legwork. They get the top guys into my queue. And then once they get to that point, then it's incumbent on me to make sure that I can reach out quite often, build those relationships, and close the deal.
You mentioned how at Penn the transfer portal is not nearly the impact it has been at a lot of other places. The impact it's having on other places, though, is it changing who is available? And I know this is your first cycle at Penn, but at this level, who's available? Because a lot of places are just going straight portal for the most part. They just pluck guys from other Division I programs and build that way. And I've heard, just talking to other coaches, it seems like in some avenues, the high school kids are not getting quite as many. I mean, the blue chippers are going to, but that maybe that next layer isn't getting the offers because those spots are being taken now by other kids in the transfer portal. Like, have you noticed any change in what's available from an athlete standpoint because of what the portals, the chaos it's wrought in other places?
Absolutely. I think you hit it on the head. I think the high school talent pool that's left for our level, I think it's a lot more rich and deep than it ever has been. I think the access to really good players that we feel like or maybe even above the FCS level from a talent standpoint, they're out there and we can go get them. And case in point, in the back half of the 26 class, you know, of we had 13 guys that signed early decision. We signed 12 guys, you know, within the first month that we were there before regular decision. And of those 12 guys, I mean, 8 or 9 of them had multiple scholarship opportunities and FBS opportunities as well. So whether they didn't get end up having to be a committable offer because those schools are now going to the transfer portal, which, you know, what it was, or obviously they saw the value in this education and playing in our program. But the talent is out there. And then for us to utilize the portal in terms of bringing guys in, it's another thing which we talked challenges before. I think it's not that easy in this conference to bring guys in. So I'm sure you're aware there was multiple years where there was 2 windows for the transfer portal. They consolidated it last year back to 1. That window now is, you know, right after Thanksgiving, and you're trying to make decisions over the Christmas break. But there's no mid-year enrollees in the Ivy League. So now you're asking a student athlete, if we're recruiting him, he was probably on scholarship at that Division I school. Hey, you need to sit out a semester, right, and not play football, go home, train and be ready to go and come here, right, and enroll in the fall for us. Or sometimes admissions might be like, hey, we need to see a couple other classes because their rigor academic profile isn't as challenging as Penn needs it. Oh, by the way, you were on scholarship. Now, can you stay at that school you're at? Probably now you went in the portal, so that coach is pulling your scholarship. So now stay there for a semester, take these 2 classes that we need you so we can get you in. So with that, we've only had 1 cycle at it, and we went after a handful of guys in the transfer portal, and it just – the timing, it didn't work for them. They didn't want to sit out a semester. They wanted to be enrolled, you know, a couple weeks after they were in the portal at their next institution so they can battle for a starting job in spring practice, right? So I think it was probably easier a couple years ago when they had that second transfer portal window because you could just bring them. You can get them in a summer class a few weeks after the portal was open, and there was probably it was a much more seamless transition. So we're going to use it as a strategy. I just don't know how viable it's going to be to say, hey, we're going to go get 5 to 8 kids per year. If we get 1 to 2, you know, it probably works out. But we weren't able to get one in that last class.
This spring, I'm curious, in your first year, how much – what's the – I don't know if balancing act, but like what – percentage is it from an X and O standpoint, we want to install what we want to do, make sure the kids understand, and how much of it is setting the culture and setting the expectation game, because there's nothing like that first time you're with the kids, like that first extended workout time. So was it a little different than maybe it will be in the future where, I mean, you always have new kids coming in, but you're setting like kind of the baseline foundation here. So does it lean more in the focus on the culture and less on X and O, if I'm making this clear?
I mean, I think you hit it right on the head. I mean, we were probably 80-20 standards, culture, how you operate, what it means to play in this program, expectations versus what we're doing from a schematic and fundamental standpoint. And I thought it was really important for myself and our staff to get out in front of the team, share our story. So, you know, we did a leadership exercise called the 4 Corners of Identity. And basically it's ways to share your story, who you are, what led you to this point in your career, and get vulnerable and explain some of the tough things and adversity that you went through in your life, some of the great things, who's a hero in your life that you want to emulate after, what your history is. And then you finish it like, what do you hope as an individual you want to get accomplished with us collectively as a group and individually how you can contribute to that. So like our staff shared their stories. The team would then get up. And so for the first 6 weeks when we would have team meetings, it was nothing to do with football. It was all, here's our core values. Here's how we operate. Here's the expectations. And then like, let's just get to know one another. In the recruitment process, when you have a full cycle, we're recruiting these guys for a full year. So we've met them, we've Zoomed with them, we've talked to their parents numerous times. They've come on unofficial visits multiple times. They take their official visit. Then we probably see them again in the spring recruiting cycle when we're on the next year's class. So like you check a lot of boxes. You feel like you really know if you do your job and do it the right way, you know a lot about who they are, what type of coaching that they need, what their family dynamic is. So you feel great about that coming in. So, you know, a lot of it is just, hey, here's what we're doing from a football standpoint, right? So we did a lot more of that this offseason. And I think going forward, it'll balance itself out. But we just felt like it was really important to set the foundation culturally.
We need to take a break. We will have more with Rick Santos in just a few moments. But right now, I want to tell you that One-on-One with Matt Leon is sponsored by your Delaware Valley Honda dealers, proud sponsor of the KYW News Radio Studios. Bring on the fun and bring home a new Honda with a great deal on your favorite Honda vehicles and finally take that road trip you've been dreaming of. Now's the time to check out the Honda Civic and HR-V from Honda, the 2025 Kelley Blue Book's KBB.com best value brand. And now on One-on-One with Matt Leon, let's return to our conversation with new University of Pennsylvania head football coach Rick Santos.
All right, so let's dig into your backstory. Mentioned you were a quarterback. Growing up, was football your number one sport, or were you playing a bunch of different things?
I played everything. Football, basketball, baseball, played soccer at one point. I didn't golf on the team, but that's still probably one of my favorite recreational things to do. I really enjoy it. Played track, you know, sophomore and junior year to try to get a little bit faster. But with all of that, I always loved football. I was a hyper-aggressive kid, very restless, so that game kind of called to me. I didn't start playing quarterback until my eighth grade year, actually. So I was first position was a defensive end, linebacker, played receiver, played safety, played running back, and then it was tryouts for freshman football. And basically the coach rolled – we didn't have a quarterback. The coach rolled out the ball and said, whoever can throw it far enough is going to start tomorrow's practice at quarterback. That happened to be me. And then I kind of ran with it and fell in love with that position. So I love the game for the camaraderie. I think it honors toughness, and I always love that. And yeah, and just the quarterback position kind of came later in my career, and I enjoyed it.
What was it specifically about playing quarterback that really resonated with you?
I love having the spotlight, the ball's in your hand. I'm an extremely competitive person, and I always felt like if I played my best, we were going to win. And I don't think that's always the case at every other position. Now, I'm not saying those positions aren't as important, you know, but you could be a phenomenal running back, and if they just don't block anybody up front, like you have no shot, and you could be wide open all the time as a receiver and the quarterback just can't get you the ball. So your stats aren't indicative of maybe how well you played. And, you know, you could have a really good game as a linebacker or safety, but maybe the position group in front of you wasn't doing what they need to. So the blocks and combinations are coming up to you as a linebacker and you can't get off them, right? So it's very much incumbent on everyone else doing their job so you can thrive. It's like that at the quarterback position, but you can make up for some ills as well. And so I always just liked that part of it. And when you didn't play well, you know, you had a shot where you probably weren't going to win the game. So just that added level of pressure on it, I always enjoyed. You felt like you needed to be thrown into a leadership role, which I don't think I understood or embraced when I was younger, but how important when the best teams I've ever been around, I think that position had been one of the hardest workers. They've been one of the best leaders. They've been a person that can kind of galvanize the locker room. So as I got older and matured and developed, I liked that aspect of it, and being the person that could be a great teammate and try to pick everyone else up when they're not having a great day and all those things. So there's a lot that goes into the position, and those are kind of some of the reasons why I loved it.
When did you start to feel like you became a really good quarterback?
You know, we had a lot of success in high school, but we were a wing tee offense, ran the ball quite a bit, didn't throw it much freshman, sophomore, junior year. Senior year, we opened it up a little bit, and that's when I felt like, okay, you know, we had won multiple state championships sophomore, junior year. But again, it was probably on the back of our running game and our defense. And then we had a new offense coordinator kind of come in, and we had some different things that we did and got more shotgun base, not under center. That's when I felt like, hey, maybe I got a shot to play at the next level and really kind of opened up my eyes to, you know, this, make a career with this game.
And you went to high school in Bellingham?
Bellingham, Massachusetts. Yeah.
Running the wing tee from a quarterback standpoint, what is that like? I think there's probably a lot of football fans that have no concept of what it is.
Yeah.
How much fun is it? How much work is it for a quarterback at the line of scrimmage?
Yep.
You know, kind of dig into all that.
Yeah. So, I mean, there's a fullback, there's two other halfbacks on the field, a tight end and a receiver. So it's condensed sets. You're running the ball 80% of the time. You're under center, and your first play that you always do in that offense is going to be fullback trap. So you open up quick, hand the ball to the fullback right behind you, and then it's a big option game. So I thought that offense helped me feel really comfortable being able to facilitate the ball, then eventually get into a Chip Kelly type offense where we did that from a spread setting. So, you know, you just have to do a phenomenal job protecting the football with your ball handling and how you do it, and the continuity you have to have between yourself and the running backs. I think it's probably as important as any offense you're going to run. So, but again, you're running it over and over and over. It's a ball control offense. It can be explosive, obviously, on the ground, and it was. You're not really – there's not much vertical passing game. Quick rollouts, quick game, getting the ball out of your hand. You're not dropping back much. We weren't in the shotgun at all for my first 3 years. So it's just – it's different than some of the things that I had played in going forward.
Can it be a frustrating offense from a quarterback standpoint because you're not throwing it, or is it just success-based, hey, we're moving up and down the field?
So – 100%. Like if you would have started in a different offensive scheme that relied more heavily on the quarterback to be productive, and then you go to that, you know, you would have felt like, hey, I've taken a step back in terms of my role in this offense. But I loved it because it felt like everyone contributed and everyone had the ability to make plays in that offense. All three running backs, you know, we'd get the tight end involved and some of the waggle and bootleg schemes and all that stuff. And, you know, the one wideout we'd have on the field at a time, like, he was really blocking more, but he took on a selfless role. But we all felt like we could contribute. Now in that too, the quarterback runs the ball a good amount, so I did feel like I was being productive, helping the team win, and finding ways to get some yards on the ground, which was great.
Is it tough when you only throw a ball 6-8 times in a game to not try to throw for 200 yards every time you throw the ball, because you know your options to show off that skill are going to be limited, and to not try to do too much? I kind of equate it to a kid who doesn't play much and gets out there and tries to do a million things because he knows he's only going to get a couple of snaps. Like how tough is it from that standpoint?
It is tough, and that's why I think it's all about coaching. And I was fortunate. My high school coach's name is Dale Caparasso. He was old school, militant, just grinded us. And his philosophy was he was going to coach his best players the hardest, because if he could coach us as sternly and at that level, then he knew everyone was going to kind of fall in line, and that was going to be our standard. We're all going to be held to the same standard and be held accountable. So he coached me really, really, really tough. And if I didn't play in the confines of the offense, and I would do that a couple times a game where I would just go rogue and pull up and throw the one vertical, you know, that was on that play instead of taking the wide open guy in the flat, like, he'd let you know in those meetings. And I always appreciated it for it. I think it's tough when you're younger and you're like, hey, man, like, your ego gets involved in, well, I'm a huge reason why we're winning, and look at all this production I've had on the ground. So I finally get an opportunity to showcase my arm. Of course I'm going to do it. But now that I'm a coach, it's like, we preach that, being selfless and we over me. And like, humility is one of our five core values. And it's really like being coachable. And if you're asked to do something that's in the betterment of the team, that's not in the betterment of the individual, like, understand why we're asking you to do it. It's not because I don't think you're a good football player. It's because this is what the team needs to be successful in that moment. And so it's lessons like that that I think make me a better coach today, because, yeah, your natural instinct is like, I got to showcase it. I want to do this selfishly for me. I want to throw the ball down the field. I need to put more that feeling of like, hey, I want to get recruited. I need to put more of this stuff on tape, so my highlight tape looks better, so I can hopefully get a scholarship one day. Like, all that stuff plays into you when you're young and naive and you don't think about the big picture. And that's why I think coaching is so important.
So you do go to New Hampshire. Why New Hampshire? What kind of sold you on going there?
Well, rewind a few years based on what we were just talking about in the offense that I played in. We were very successful in terms of winning. I had a lot of production in terms of what I did on the ground. So I garnered a good amount of FBS interest in, you know, teams like Boston College and Syracuse and Penn State and Iowa. And these schools had visited my high school and had seen me and invited me out to camp. So I felt like I was on a trajectory to play FBS really after my junior year. And back then there wasn't these camps like Rivals or the ESPN, you know, 300 camps where you can go get verified metrics and all those things. You would go to whatever your local FBS camp was, and that was your way to kind of get seen. So I went to Boston College camp going into my senior year, and I didn't test well. You know, I didn't run that fast. I didn't jump that high compared to some of the other guys that they were really recruiting. My arm strength wasn't nearly where it needed to be to play at that level. So I think the FBS dream fell off in that summer. Still had the entire back then. It was the Atlantic 10 Conference, you know, the New Hampshires, the UMass, the Rhode Islands, the Maines, like Northeastern had football back then. And those schools were all in on me. I was waiting on three or four of them. I thought the offers were going to come. And every week that went by senior year, nothing came. And, you know, the story goes at New Hampshire, they'd offered eight out of the guys. They all committed elsewhere. I was like the last one on their board. And Chip Kelly was the offense coordinator. Sean McDonald was the head coach. And Bobby Bicknell, who's been all over, I think he was at Boston College at the time, came down and they all watched they watched me play basketball. And, you know, I hustled, made some hustle plays. It wasn't even what I did from a skill standpoint. I think they just hopefully liked the effort and the toughness that I displayed out there. And really, I guess they were stuck with me. It was the only scholarship they had left. It was the last one in the class that they took that year. And so New Hampshire, why there is it was really my only opportunity to play Division I. I'd visited multiple times. Now, I'd loved the area. I'd loved everything about it. I'd always wanted to play for Sean McDonald, just what he stood for. So everything worked out really well for me from that standpoint. But yeah, it just I share that story at times, and I sometimes share it to the guys that were recruiting in camp, because I think for me what I notice is like there's no crystal ball in recruiting. Sometimes you'll win these recruiting battles against 10 other schools and someone has multiple FBS and FCS scholarship opportunities and they get there and maybe they don't have the mental makeup that you thought and they fizzle out and don't really ever contribute or be productive. And then some of the guys that are your last takes and you just say, hey, we have a spot. I think there's something there. And you take a flyer on a guy and they become your best players. I mean, at New Hampshire, like we got Dave Ball that I played with who had all – he broke every single one of Jerry Rice's FCS records. Now, subsequently, Cooper Kupp has broken most of those when he was at Eastern Washington. He walked on the team. He was a track scholarship guy, partially. Walked on football and broke all those records, started for 4 years. You know, we've had three or four walk-on captains at UNH and guys that just were afterthoughts, right? So I just think it's really finding out mentally – what the guys are about, do they love football, and how tough they are. I think if you can prioritize those things even before kind of what their highlight tape says, I think that's going to have some staying power of like getting the most out of the guys you recruit.
Did you take the recruiting journey you went on as a challenge? Was there a little bit of, okay, I'm going to show you how good this is going to be?
Kept receipts of every single head coach that was still in the conference when we played them. And again, I had a lot of growing up to do, and I was an overly confident kid when I always believed in myself, and then there was a part of it like, well, maybe I think too much of myself and I'm not really a Division I player, because obviously it all fell off. And then getting the opportunity, it just reconfirmed, though, I can do it. Having some success early when I was a redshirt freshman. So then, you know, your sophomore, junior year, you've established yourself, you're playing, and yeah, you'd go against these head coaches that passed on you, that told you we were going to have a scholarship waiting, that it wasn't there. I used that as fire, and it helped fuel me to have a lot of success when we were there.
So you mentioned Chip Kelly is the offensive coordinator at New Hampshire, obviously former Eagles coach. He's been tons of places, had tons of success. What is stepping into his offense like as a 19-year-old?
He demands excellence, if not perfection, every single day. And if you didn't have a mastery level understanding of his offense, and I don't care if you're a true freshman, I don't care if you're a fifth year senior, wherever you fell in that spectrum, he was going to let you know. And the way he would command us and coach us really, really hard, it fit my personality well. Some guys crumbled in that environment. There were some uncomfortable days in those meeting rooms. And if you couldn't handle tough coaching, you just couldn't play for him. And I was fortunate that I just kind of grew up in that with some of my high school coaches in football and basketball, and I was used to it. But it was hard. It was – you'd have – production, you know, that redshirt freshman year when I got thrust into it and ended up playing because a couple guys got hurt. And then we had success and we went on a run. You know, I remember one game vividly. It was Villanova. They were top eight in the country. We go down there. You know, it's maybe my third or fourth game ever starting. I mean, we put up 40-something points. I think I had 540 yards of total offense, five touchdowns. We upset a top 10 team. Epic. Everyone's happy. You know, and you go to Sunday meetings and I get graded out at 48% because my footwork wasn't great and I passed over some wide open guys. And half the time I probably – my progression started on the wrong side of the field and my eyes weren't where they needed to be, right? And he was just like, no, this is the offense. You went rogue. You made some plays. This isn't sustainable. Like just because you held the ball too long and you evaded multiple guys and you scrambled and threw a 50-yard highlight touchdown, that's not how this – offense operates. That's not going to win over the long haul. And you just respect him for it. Like he had his principles, he had his ways. And obviously did we know he was going to turn into that coach? No, but we knew we were always prepared. He was extremely innovative. We always felt like we had an edge or a leg up on the opponents that we were going against because there was always some new wrinkles that he was going to throw every single week that usually seemed to work. So I owe him a lot for how he coached me.
What is it like just as a kid to go from running, maybe throwing the ball six times a game, to a Chip Kelly offense where you're throwing it everywhere?
Yep.
And everything, like, you know, what you're doing in high school is ball control.
Yep.
This is score as quickly as possible. It must have been your brain almost breaks it at a certain point because it's so different.
It's so different. At high school, it was huddling. I would run to the sideline. I'd get the play. I'd run back in. I'd give it to the huddle. We'd methodically get to the line of scrimmage, and we'd snap it late in the play clock and just bleed the game out, win ugly, try to control the clock and win that way. It was the exact opposite. In college, we did not care about time of possession. We cared about how many snaps we could get in the game and playing as fast as humanly possible. And we felt like by the second half, we were going to wear teams down. And we certainly did that. And so it's more shotgun than under center, a lot more passing, a lot more quick games. So like the perimeter attachments, the quick games, the now screens and meeting, just catch the ball, throw it to a receiver close to the sideline, let him get four or five. That was an extension of our run game, which was something that we had never done before. And the one thing that I think helped me a lot and the correlations between the offense was we did run everything. There was like some triple option components to it. So even a simple inside zone, you would still read the defensive end. So that's option. It's just not from under. It's from – you have a little more time to read it and make the mesh point and read it. But – so we would do that. We were doing stuff back then that I don't think many people were, where like he would leave defensive tackles unblocked and have the linemen just quickly get up to the second level guys, and we would read D tackles and different things. So then you would add a motion element, which we would do in the wing T. So like that stuff, I think it helped me play in his offense because of how I had to facilitate the football, get out of my hands quick, make reads in an expedited manner. So that part of it, I think, you know, really, really helped me. But there was a lot of it that was vastly different, that it was just really trial by fire.
How much of an adjustment just from a stamina standpoint did it take running his offense?
Yeah, it took a couple of years really to get it down pat. I would say redshirted, was on scout team my freshman year, redshirt freshman year. So sophomore year academically played. And then it was that my junior year, sophomore year academically is really when I felt comfortable in that offense and we could run it. And now a lot of it too is going through an off season with that offense in mind, because how we practice, you need to make sure that it correlates to how you train. And we trained hard and it was very demanding. And, you know, the mat drills and some of the things that like Urban Meyer was famous for back in the day. Chip and Coach McDonald would meet with him when he was at like Bowling Green, and we took some of those off-season protocols and implemented at the University of New Hampshire. And I thought we felt like that was always our secret sauce. We were a little bit tougher, a little more edgy, because that stuff was really hard, and we were just in such unbelievable condition by the time we got to the season. So I think a part of it is you can play in that offense once you fully have a full off-season to kind of immerse yourself in what it takes to get in shape.
What is it like as a quarterback when it is cooking, when you are in shape, and the defense, you're breaking the defense?
Yeah.
Like the swearing and the heavy breathing that you get from a defensive line, it's got to be so satisfying from your point because you're imposing your will on them. And it's a different way of imposing your will. We usually think of that, like you said, grinding 4 yards at a time and just slow. This is just you're just running them ragged.
We knew when we had teams when he would call the same play, not just twice, not just three times, four, five times in a row. Simple inside zone play, and we're getting 4, 6, 8, 10 yards a chunk, and the fourth one rips for 25 yards because they're on their heels and we're dictating the terms of engagement and just you know, doing what we want. As you mentioned, imposing your will. That was something we always want to talk about doing. And those are some great moments where you just felt like, hey, we got them right where we want them. There's method to the madness of how we train and practice, and we had some marathon practices back then, and we just would go so hard. And even after in season two hour and 45 minute practice, which if you look at now, like that's just the science says that's the exact opposite of maybe what you should be doing to stay fresh. But we would do it, and then we would condition. And you're just like, man, you were just so beat down during the week. But for whatever reason, we got to game day, and we felt like mentally that gave us an edge. And the legs were a little tired. We certain, you know, the lungs weren't, and we had some competitive stamina for it. And we just felt like, hey, man, like this is who we are. This is our identity. And when you saw it come to fruition and making plays on the field, I think the buy-in was really high between us and the staff.
You mentioned that one game against Villanova where your numbers were off the charts, and Chip Kelly's like, you only scored 48%. Did you ever register 100%? And is that possible in a Chip Kelly?
No. It was like low 80s was a good game. You know, like if you could get anywhere near the 80s, you felt like you were really, really efficient.
And he was basing that, like you said, on footwork, progression, stuff like that.
Yeah, because your production grade could be a plus, but your footwork or your eyes weren't in the right spot. So that's a negative, and it would all come together into one grade at the end. So yeah, it was tough to truly have perfect footwork, perfect eyes, be disciplined with all that, and then make it a productive play.
So 3-time All-American, you win the Walter Payton Award. Did you realize in real time the impact you were having on New Hampshire football, on FCS football? You know, did it register what you were in the midst of doing, or was it just kind of, yeah, we're having success, this is fun, and we're winning?
I don't think it registered until probably my junior year, which would have been the guy I mentioned before, Dave Ball, our receiver, his senior year. He was at home, I believe it was against Richmond, and he broke Jerry Rice's all-time receiving record of like 53 or something like that. And I just remember being like, wow, like I grew up watching Jerry Rice. It's the one of my favorite players of all time. I just loved how he operated. I love those 49ers teams, just all of that. And I was like, this was a childhood idol of mine. And to have one of my best friends break his records, I was like, we're doing some really unique things here. So, and then after that year was when I was fortunate enough to win the Walter Payton. And then you get a chance, you know, I met his son, Jared, who then, and actually a couple of years later, played with him in Canada, and just meeting the Payton family, what they're about, you know, you knew of Walter Payton, but obviously like when I was a kid, he was finishing up, and just like how impactful of a player he was for football in general and the NFL and all that. And I remember that's when it really hit me. It was just humbling to kind of be named after a player of that greatness.
Given all that, what are you most proud of your college playing days?
I think the legacy that our class had left. The wins were great, but I think it was how we did it, the consistency in which we operated. And, you know, I think before then, I think New Hampshire had only been to one or two playoffs in the history of the school. And for us to go 4 straight, and then we felt like when we left it in a really good place. We felt like we left it better than we found it. And with that, that started a generational run of they went to 14 straight years in the playoffs. So we felt like, hey, our class did something really special. Now there was something to sell in the recruitment process. It was like, here's here's us winning. We have a proven formula of success, and this is how we practice. This is how we build relationships. This is what it looks like. And a lot of those things were kind of built on the back of myself and our classmates. So that was – the wins are awesome, but I think it was more just of leaving it a place where other people saw that as a destination school. And I don't know if it was that way before.
Time for another break. More with Rick Santos coming up. But right now, I want to remind you that One-on-One with Matt Leon is sponsored by your Delaware Valley Honda dealers, proud sponsor of the KYW News Radio Studios. Bring on the fun and bring home a new Honda with a great deal on your favorite Honda vehicles. And finally, take that road trip you've been dreaming of. Now's the time to check out the Honda Civic and HR-V from Honda, the 2025 Kelley Blue Books KBB.com best value brand. And now on One-on-One with Matt Leon, let's get back to our conversation with new University of Pennsylvania head football coach Rick Santos.
So you graduate, you get a shot with the Kansas City Chiefs. What did that entail? They brought you in as an undrafted free agent. Was that just a camp?
Yeah, you know what? I still feel like my professional career was really not even just a bit of a letdown. I feel it's a letdown, and I didn't kind of live up to what I felt like I was capable of. And that maybe started senior year when I blew out my shoulder. I tore three ligaments in my throwing arm, and so I battled through. I was supposed to get surgery. I was like, I'm not going to miss any time. So I played the last 6 or 7 weeks, and do I get surgery after the season, which I probably should have? I don't. So I go through it, you know, don't have great pro days, and some of the medical doctors of the team, so when they saw me, they didn't love it. So, like, you know, don't get invited to the combine. All those things were like, hey, maybe I'm going to get drafted after my junior year, and projected that could be the case to not getting drafted. Now you go in there. They kind of already had their top three guys solidified. So I knew I was battling against for a third string job against a guy, I think his name was Tyler Thigpen back then, who had played at Coastal Carolina. He had won the Walter Payton, I think, like 3 years earlier, but he had been there. He knew the system and just wasn't able to make headway and do that. Got released after camp. And then obviously I was in Canada, and was great experience in terms of being a part of winning teams. And we won a couple Grey Cup championships. But I just always felt when it got done that I left a lot to be desired. And I think that's why I always say coaching kind of saved me. You know, I was lost for about a year. I always identified myself as an athlete and through football in general. And when that was stripped away from me, you know, I was about 28, 29 years old back home, living back with my parents for the first time in nearly 10 years, sleeping in my high school room, looking around. I was like, I still think they had like some of my high school trophies up there. And I just remember looking at the ceiling, having restless nights, being like, I was supposed to be a millionaire by 25 and retiring my mom, and now here I am, like, basically dead broke, starting all over. And that's why I volunteered coaching at Bellingham, where I was, and I loved it that first year, and had the opportunity to go back in that following year and coach at UNH, and that's when my collegiate journey started.
Had coaching been on your radar prior? Like, did you think about eventually that would be fun, or were you just so focused on playing?
I was so singular focused on playing. And now that's why I really enjoy coaching, because I was young and naive, and I didn't I always did well in the classroom, and I was certainly smart enough. But did I apply it in terms of, like, having a plan B and C and what I wanted to do? It's like, no, like, I'm playing. I'm going to the NFL. And a part of that was probably what allowed me to be that successful and reach some heights playing in college. A lot of people don't. But at the same time, like, prepared for life after football, I certainly was not. So, no, I didn't think about getting the coaching. I thought maybe I was going to teach at the high school level, work my way up, be an athletic director. I thought, you know, I took some marketing classes in college. I was like, maybe I get into marketing, the professional side of it. Maybe I'll get into sales. I always liked people and being social and those sort of things, and felt like I could do well in that standpoint. And but no, I did not have coaching on my radar.
The Canadian experience, just from a pure X and O football standpoint, how much of an adjustment is it from a quarterback? Because the field dimensions are different.
Yep.
You've got more room to work with, one less down.
Yep.
Like, how does it change what you do as a quarterback?
A lot more of a passing league. I think you pick your spots when you're going to run the football. You know, obviously it's so critical to get it into second and manageable, where, like, obviously second down to a big down in American football. But if you have an awful, you don't get anything, it ends up being second and 10, you're still open a little bit. Hey, I can still I can sneak off 5 or 6 yards in a run and make it third and manageable. I could throw and get half the distance, but it's like you're 2nd and 10 in that league. You're throwing it. You know, you're not really trying to sneak a run in there. So I think from that standpoint, it was different. It required a big arm, and the field was so massive, and you're making those throws, those outcuts to the field and the corner balls and the conversions and all that stuff. And that's when, like, I was like, wow, this is – I know it's just Canada, but there's some elite football players up there. Also, it was around the same time, 08, you know, financial crisis, everything that went on with that. Like, NFL Europe folded within a month of me coming out. And then Arena One folded as well. And back then, like, Arena One quarterbacks were making a good amount of money. I mean, that's when Kurt Warner came from. There's some other guys that came from that league. So the influx of talent in the CFL during that time, I thought, was probably as good as it had been in that conference maybe ever. So just to even make the team, you know, it was like beating out guys like – or playing with guys like Adrian McPherson, who, you know, this guy was Mr. Basketball – and football in the state of Florida. He went to Florida State. Chris Leak was on our team, and a guy like Brad Banks, who played at Iowa, and I think he was 2nd in the Heisman his senior year, right? So you're just like, I thought, okay, hey, about to be an NFL talent, doesn't work out. I'm going to Canada. Like, I'm going to absolutely dominate in this conference. And then you're just like, wow. It's still professional football. It's still an unbelievable league, and you were battling just to be a backup or third string for the time that I was there.
When did you come to peace with your playing days being over and you didn't get maybe the NFL look you hoped and stuff like that? Because you said you struggled with identity. A lot of guys do when the door closes. Yeah. Like, was there a point where you realized that I'm good with it? Was it almost immediate with the coaching that kind of filled that void?
Yeah, it took probably close to a year. It started to help me and get me out of my own head and help serve others when that first year when I volunteered at Bellingham where I went. And we were just okay, but we sent a couple guys, D2, D3, and just helping them navigate their journey and the ability to play in college, which they wanted to do. Like, that was fulfilling for me. And then probably took a whole – that next cycle when I had the ability to go to UNH and start over there, start my collegiate coaching experience and just being immersed back in it. And that competitive drive was fulfilled once again. And you know, we had success early when I was an assistant coach there. And a couple of those first years, we were really, really good. And I coached receivers for the first three and was so fortunate. A guy by the name of RJ Harris was there. And such a great player. He was a 2-year All-American for the 2 years that we worked together. And just helping him grow and mature. And, you know, he had a lot of the natural traits that, you know, I wasn't going to coach out of him. He had it. But just really from a mental standpoint, helping him mature and navigate some of the things, that's when I really was like, oh, I love this. Like, this is a lot of fun. I can still be around the game and I can help teach and navigate these guys with some of the things that helped me be successful. But I think the things that's most rewarding as a coach is like, hey, like, here's the things that you're not even thinking about right now that I went through that could be some pitfalls if you don't equip yourself mentally to be able to handle those things. And like, just being there for those guys, that's when that next year really I was like, okay, I'm all in on this.
Did the success when you started New Hampshire as an assistant, you know, you're all over the record book, your number's retired, like, did that give you cachet with the players? Like, where Santos, is that you, coach? Is that you?
I instantly had street cred with the guys from that standpoint and again, like, never coaching at the collegiate level, never coaching quarterback, I mean, never coaching receivers and not playing it since Pop Warner. It was a big adjustment in terms of like the technical side and teaching breakpoint mechanics and how to stock block and some of the things that I'd never done from a physical standpoint. But just knowing how to teach defenses, knowing that offense in and out, there was still some remnants of some things that were obviously Chip wasn't still there, but still some remnants of how we did things and teaching them, hey, from the lens of a quarterback, this is why the timing is so important on this route. You can't get out of your cut too quickly because you're number three in the progression and just, hey, man, like, this is the window that the QB expects of you. So like, that helped me a lot. And I think it was a lot more seamless of a transition teaching that position than I thought it was going to be. But also, I started over in terms of I went from being the head coach is, I think, maybe one of his favorite players of all time, to now I'm the last coach on the depth chart, and I was a brand new coach and didn't know everything, and he coached me like I was a freshman And he coached super hard and made sure he would call me in every single day when a drill wasn't set up properly and if I'd have to explain why our position wasn't doing what they need to do in practice, maybe more than some of the other coaches that have been around because they had already earned his trust. So that was hard, really, really hard, challenging at first, but it helped me grow. And now teaching young coaches, you know, coaching the coaches, I think is a big part of being a head coach that I think being that like those things were so invaluable with him showing me the way, which is great.
Given that, when do you start to think you hit your stride? Like you as how you came across to the players, but also doing what the head coach expected of you. How long did that take?
Probably a year or two coaching. Probably took me a whole full year. And then with that as well, like I had some special teams responsibilities and never had played in any of those in obviously in high school and college. You know, so it's coaching the punt return team and learning that stuff. I think it just opened my eyes to how important everybody is on every side of the ball matters, offense, defense, and special teams, and how great teams have cohesive units and how they all play off one another. And you're always just so singular focused, obviously, as a player on your side of the ball and really not even your side of the ball. It's like doing your job at a high level. And we're always coaching the guys, do your job. Don't focus on anyone else. And like, you know, you got to earn the right to do more and bring other people along. And you got to do your job first. And as a young coach, that's what it was. And then you start getting more responsibility. Then you start understanding how to craft an offensive game plan and then having more involvement in special teams. And that's when it's just like, okay, I understand a lot more of what it takes to be a successful coach. And then that eventually, as each year passes, you've earned the right to have more responsibility. And then you're like, okay, I understand a decent amount of this stuff. Then you start thinking, hey, maybe down the road at some point, you know, I could be a head coach, and you start kind of crafting how you would do things. And these are the things that are non-negotiables that have always worked here. These are the things, hey, man, question mark, do we like it? Do we want to tweak it? These are some of the things like, hey, if I was doing it, I would probably do it separately and whatever. And you start to build that out as you go before you even become a head coach.
How much do you think the diversity of offenses you ran has helped you as a coach? Because like you were a key part of an offense, like you said, fullback trap, mm-hmm. which is like day one
yep.
install. To the different things at levels and sequence that Chip Kelly's doing, like, how does that make you a better coach? Because maybe you have an appreciation for skill sets that work in different situations that someone who doesn't have the plethora of hands-on experience doesn't have the quite appreciation for.
I think that's a great point. And then even step further, so right, high school was wing T, then it was up-tempo spread offense, and then professionally in Canada, in Montreal, I was so fortunate. I played under Mark Trestman, and for anyone listening doesn't know, like before that he was the head coach of the Chicago Bears. He was the offensive coordinator under Bill Walsh and some of those San Francisco 49er days when had some dynasties. So like he was a West Coast pro-style system. Everything was timing. It was all about quarterback footwork and how that footwork was so integral in the timing of the routes and all that. So that's a vastly different offense than what Chip was running, and then obviously different than what we did in high school. So now having all three that require different skill sets, different personnel, it was awesome. And to go circle back to your question, I think it allows me now that like a successful coach isn't stubborn and stuck in his ways. We run this system no matter what, and this is what we're doing it. We have system that we feel like works, but it's all incumbent on who our best players are. And now being in all three of those, having the ability to tailor an offense based on our personnel. So sometimes in recruiting at this level, you're going to recruit guys to your system, but there might be some guy who's just too good to pass up, and maybe he's a little bit different than what your ideal version of an offense is and doesn't quite fit it, but he's just such a dynamic player, big, physical, strong, great person, great character, all that stuff. And you take this person and you're like, all right, you know, we have three tight ends that are really good now, and so we're not going to be up-tempo and spread. Maybe we're going to have some 13 personnel sets, meaning three tight ends on the field, and we're going to do some unbalanced stuff and run the ball and get a little more heavy in terms of those things, right? And it's finding creative ways to put your best players on the field. And I think that was probably the biggest luxury in playing all of those offenses is having enough understanding of overarching like offensive football, which is cool.
When you eventually become the head coach, now you first become interim head coach, correct?
Yes.
You spend 1 year as interim and then you go back to an assistant before you take over the program.
Yep.
What was that experience like as the interim? Did you feel ready and you know, interim situations are just different.
Yep.
So what was the experience like?
No, I was not ready at all. So I came back. So it was 2019. I just got done 3 years at Columbia. So came back and was coaching quarterbacks. I mean, I did decent. I wasn't the coordinator. Obviously, Ryan Carty was the offense coordinator, which is now the head coach at Delaware. But he was the offense coordinator. But we had a great relationship. And, you know, so he gave me a good amount of responsibility in terms of offensive game planning. But coaching quarterbacks there. And then Ryan had left. So he was there, and then he had just left, like in that spring transition. We were back for a little bit, trying to figure out what that was going to be. I thought I was going to get the full-time offense coordinator job. Coach McDonald, he went some other guys that had been on staff for a while. So maybe, you know, it was like more recruiting, whatever. So we get to the season, and about a week before the season started, he told us that he had bladder cancer. Thank God he beat it. He's in remission. He's doing phenomenal. But the doctors, obviously, he's so tough and old school. Like, he was just gonna tough it out and go through it. And they obviously forced him to step down for the year. So he named me the head coach, the interim for that year. And so I was still coaching quarterbacks. So, I mean, I'm running position meetings throughout the day, having staff meetings for the first time, trying to organize everything. Obviously, now having the ability to, like, I could craft the entire offense if I want. And, like, me going into it thinking, hey, I felt like I was slighted. I wanted to be the offense coordinator. Now I'm the head coach. Now I'm like, hey, man, I'm actually technically your boss. So, like, we're going to do it this way. So it was figuring out that dynamic between the offensive staff. But I think ultimately we did a really good job and had a collaborative effort on that side of it. It was hard. It was like running those meetings, running the staff meetings, coming up with the motivation of the week, pre-practice, you know, just trying to get the guys focused and all that stuff, having tough personnel conversations with other guys that weren't starting or why they're not starting and all those things that I just had never gone through. So, you know, we had a couple of tough games and we ended up 6-5. We were, I think, third in the conference. So in conference play, we did pretty well. But we lost some games that maybe we shouldn't have. But you know what? You're never ready for that moment. But I learned so much from it, things that I felt like went well, things that I felt like we needed to clean up. And obviously, it went well enough where the athletic director named me head coach in waiting after those 6 months. So that was it was great.
Is it difficult once you're in that situation where you're the decision maker? It's a unique situation because then you go back on staff for – a while, and like I said, you're coaching waiting, but you're not the head coach at this point. Yeah. Like, it's easy to get used to making the decisions and having you decide when the trains run. Is it difficult to take the step back, especially in the same environment? And you know, you obviously had a relationship with everybody, but it's human nature. Was it difficult?
It was. It certainly was. But I give a ton of credit to Sean McDonald for easing that process. So he didn't know. You know, so 19 season, you know, so then COVID happened, kind of college football, everything kind of shut down for like a year. But he didn't know if he had 1 year left, 2 years, 3 years. He just knew he was going to go out on his own terms. He was feeling himself again and he had the energy and wanted to do it the right way. So he afforded me the ability to run a lot of the things alongside of him, meaning I was in charge of recruiting. So I had the final personnel. He knew, hey, if I'm only here for a year or two, like, I want you to recruit your guys. So final decision making on who we were taking from a recruitment standpoint, when we would do home visits that time of year, he wasn't going on the road. I was going in there doing the home visits. When we did official visits, he would be there a little bit, but he gave me the ability to talk to the room. This is what our program's going to look like going forward. He would say, hey, I'm not sure if I'm here for another year or two, and I know people are negatively recruiting us, but we have a succession plan in place. This is what it's going to look like, and leave the room and allow me to build the relationship with the parents and the student athletes. He would bring me on alumni engagement trips and fundraising trips, and really those were me just being a fly on the wall of how he operated. But that was so invaluable, and I think the things that nerved me up about what I didn't know about the position, am I even ready after the interim year? And I still had a lot of questions in myself and the imposter syndrome and like doubting yourself and all that. That eased a lot of it just because he kind of empowered me to do some of those things. And yeah, that was awesome for me. So by the time he ended up retiring and that was off season going to the 22 campaign, I had done so much of what it needed to be from an off-season standpoint. So I felt confident going into it.
Does success hit differently as a coach than it did as a player?
Yeah, I think so. I think you want it more. If you do it right, you want it more for the players than yourself. I think as a player, you know, you probably have a little more self-interest involved in it. I think that's natural. I think self-interest is good. You know, ego is not. Like when it has to be about you to be successful, or you're not, you know, you don't have great body language, it's not great. But if you truly want to be successful, I think everyone that's ever accomplished anything, like they have self-belief and they want the best for themselves. So that's natural. But I think as a coach, it's not as much that way. Like, you know, you know that if you empower your student athletes, if they have a lot of success, then naturally then you're going to get some credit, which is great. But it's really about them and empowering them to be the best that they can possibly be. So I think it's different. What I will say is I think I have more nerves before a game as a coach than I did as a player, because you don't control. You can only control so much. We went through practice. I feel like we're prepared. I hit all the checklists of situational football. I feel like it's a great game plan, but shoot, man, we're relying on 18 to 22 year olds to go out there and to be disciplined in the moment. And heaven forbid, like, we don't have success early. Like, mentally, how are they going to be? Or if someone's trying to be an instigator on the other side of the ball and they push you after the play, like, do they have the discipline in the moment to do it? And all the things you coach, but you're not the one doing it. And like, so those things, it's like, man, the jitters I have pregame as a head coach, I don't think I've ever I've ever felt anything like that as a player.
How would the relationship be between Rick Santos, the coach, and Rick Santos, the player, if you were interacting with your younger self in a coach-player situation?
My freshman year, I don't think I would have liked myself. I would have been like, man, you have a lot – you need to understand what hard work is at this level. You're not as good as you think you are. It's not about you. You're playing this position. You got to make sure that you can build your teammates up and be a better leader than you're being. I think as I developed, though, my last couple years, you know, I think he would have been proud of the player and most importantly person that I ended up developing into.
Final question. Someone is a fan of Penn football, comes out to watch Penn football, interacts with the program in any way. What is the one thing you hope they take away from your time as a head coach at the University of Pennsylvania and your program?
I think that it's two things, but it's connected. High energy and we're connected. I think when they watch us interact, they can feel it. It's palpable. They see that the guys love one another. And once they love one another and truly are going to play for something bigger than themselves, like the style in which we're going to play, you know, it's going to be fast, physical, and relentless, and they're going to do all those things. And that starts with you being connected. You wanted to play as hard as humanly possible for the person next to you. And I think if we can continue to harp on that, and it's all about the relationships and caring for our teammates, then I think the scoreboard's going to take care of itself.
Rick Santos, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you. Appreciate having me.
And that will do it for this edition of One-on-One with Matt Leon, sponsored by your Delaware Valley Honda dealers. Get a deal you'll like on a Honda you'll love. Want to thank University of Pennsylvania head football coach Rick Santos for coming in studio and being our guest this week. Now, if you like the show, if you listen on Apple Podcasts, do us a big favor. Leave us a rating and a review. We could really use it. You can follow the show on X at One-on-One Pod. You can follow me there as well at MattLeon1060. Thanks so much for listening, and be sure to check us out again next time when we bring you another conversation with someone you should know more about.